We have been tracing through the book of Ecclesiastes, especially these first really six chapters, the theme, life lived merely under the sun is futile. Ecclesiastes suggests two ways to live, under the sun or in the fear of God. And before he ever shows you the joy, the benefit of living in the fear of God, he really explores the darkness of living merely under the sun. And so we're trying to exhaust that dark quest with Solomon as he explores it through these first six chapters. We have considered together the ceaseless cycle of existence and how that really confronts us, that the end of our quest leads us with no significance. We've pursued pleasure and found it also empty in chapter 2. Last week we considered the limitations of wisdom, that even wisdom in and of itself may alleviate some of the frustrations of life, and yet at the same time it may add to them. And so those three areas in specific were lending itself to this voice that echoes over and over again, life merely lived under the sun is futile. This week we turn to Ecclesiastes chapter 2, starting in verse 18, and we'll go through the end of the chapter as we consider the frustrations of labor, the frustrations of labor. Let's do this. Let's start in the front here with Liz. And can we just work our way across reading each verse? So we'll start with verse 18. I think we're going to the end of the chapter, which is verse 26. So you can see in those verses, he's wrestling with this idea of, if I give myself to work, can I find a sense of fulfillment in it? And you saw about 10 times or more him using this term of toiling. And really, it's a redundant phrase in the Hebrew, the toil for which I toil, emphasizing that he's really giving himself to this. You know, in America, there seems to be a disconnect between how people talk about work and how they engage in it. For example, consider these following quotations made by random people about work. I love deadlines. I love the whooshing noise they make as they go by. Another, I like work. It fascinates me. I can sit and look at it for hours. I like this one. I always arrive late at the office, but I make up for it by leaving early. I think this was Teddy Roosevelt's that said this one. We often miss opportunity because it's dressed in overalls and looks like work. True. This is a guy that wrote a book, and I guess he's some kind of a comedian. I'm on the government watch list, but I'm not interested because government watches only work 20 minutes out of every hour. That's great. And then another guy here, if you had to identify in one word the reason why the human race has not achieved and never will achieve its full potential, the word would be meetings. We recognize in quotes like that, and all of us have had conversations about work where we joke about our workplace, we joke about our commitment to it, but consider some of these statistics that tell us what the workplace looks like in America. Americans work on an average of 8 hours and 16 minutes a day, totaling 1,778 hours a year. Now, those are just numbers, but it is interesting to consider that since 1970, the average hours of work in a year has skyrocketed by 200. So just over the last 40 years, people have increasingly given themselves to work. Almost 86% of men, 67% of working women work more than 40 hours a week. There's 10 million Americans working 60-hour-plus work weeks. 70% of American children live in households where all adults in the family are working. The United States is the only industrialized country in the world that has no legally mandated annual vacation. And while 134 countries have laws setting the maximum length of the work week, America does not, as we all know, which is why some of our friends aren't with us here even on a Sunday morning. One in three Americans don't use their vacation days, even when they have them, and 30% of those who do don't relax during vacation. In fact, there's actually been a term coined, leisure sickness, that a lot of workaholics experience, in which from headaches to migraines to even nausea, they're unable to just relax, and so their body continues to manifest itself in stress. 27% of workers have not taken a personal or sick day in the last few years. 60% of workers take a 20-minute or less lunch break. 10% of American employees bring work home with them at a minimum of every other day. 24% confess thinking about work when at home or being social. And there's even, you can Google it this afternoon, you'll find a Workaholics Anonymous website that allows workaholics to go through a 12-step process to recovery, and there are over 50 such recovery communities worldwide. And so on the one hand, we might say that we don't like to work, but apparently in America, there's a lot of people addicted to it. There's nothing new under the sun. 3,000 years ago, the one who is here, our guide on our quest for fulfillment, meaning, finality in life, he found his quest taking him to the workplace. And there, he discovered, like he had with so many other areas of life, that life merely lived under the sun is futile. And so we're going to follow him to the workplace today. We're going to consider if in the workplace, that which we earn, because after all, we don't find ourselves addicted to work because of work. We find ourselves addicted to work because of the profit of it. So when we consider the profit, when we consider the earnings, is it really as vain, as futile, as Solomon is going to here suggest? Well, let's trace his findings and consider it with him. Number one, you'll notice each point is dealing with different kinds of earnings. Number one, material earnings are passing. Material earnings are passing. Solomon's a hard worker. If you were to take time this afternoon to read 1 Kings 1 through 10, you're going to read about all of his building projects that he had initiated and administrated. He was no slacker. In fact, 10 times he's going to use the term labor. Twice he's going to use the term business in these 9 verses. He talks about everything he had worked so hard for. My toil for which I had toiled. The redundancy is just stressing the addiction, as it were, that he had to work, but it's also serving as a part for the whole. The toil for which I had toiled, that's why some of your translations are going to say the fruit for which I had labored. That's what he's talking about. There was a fruit that I had worked so hard for to receive, and it could only come through toil. He's a hard worker, and he'd earned much fruit through his labor. But when he considered verses 18 and 20, all the labor that I had taken under the sun, verse 20, I caused my heart to despair. And verse 18, I hated it. So from what we read, that's a pretty harsh assessment of everything that he had done. And he had given himself to it. So from what we read previously, why does he conclude that about his work? That I hated it. And I despaired over it. From the text, why is he saying that? What's the key reason there? What's that? Vanity. Why is he giving it that term, vanity? It's vanity, futility.
Because he's
going to
die.
Yeah, it's that whole idea of succession. I have to leave it behind in the hands of another. His material earnings were transient, fleeting, passing away, at least from his clutches, and his successor would inherit all that he had worked for. And that was further driven home by two realities about that successor. First, the successor was untested. The successor is untested. He reflects in verses 18 and 19, "Who knoweth whether the one that comes after me, my successor, shall be a wise man or a fool?" I don't know. He's untested. He's never been in my position. He's never dealt with my responsibilities. We don't know yet if he's going to continue the legacy or if he's going to single-handedly bring it down. And so he says in verse 19, and notice the personal pronouns, "He shall have rule over all my labor wherein I have labored and wherein I have showed myself wise under the sun." I've done it all and he's going to get it and he's not even tested. You know, Solomon's ponderings have been repeated in many a CEO's and president's mind today. Statistics tell us, rather, that 90% of U.S. businesses are family firms. And then get this, only a little more than 30% of them survive into the second generation. You know, my grandfather started a business. He was an independent insurance agency, the Floyd Lewis Insurance Agency. His son actually took it over. That was my dad. Today, it's been sold and merged into another company. So that would be part of the 30% that did survive into the second generation, but only 12% survived into the third generation. My grandfather's business would be part of the 88 that didn't, and only 3% survived into the fourth generation. How many granddads have seen that? I started a company, I put my back into it, my labor, I toiled, and then none of my sons wanted to take it over and it doesn't exist anymore. Or maybe my son did, but he didn't have the same kind of business sense I had, and he ran it into the ground. And so he concludes in verse 19, I know what to do with those kind of statistics. It equals vanity. Number two, my successor is not only untested, but he's also unentitled. I'm going to leave my earnings behind, verse 18, for another man to rule over, verse 19, as his portion, the word is inheritance there, even though verse 21, he has not labored therein. So he has earned his fruit, he admits, verse 21, through wisdom and knowledge. The word equity means skill. Okay, I've worked hard and I've worked efficiently for this. And I'm going to pass it out to another guy who's not entitled to it. He hasn't earned it. He hasn't worked for it. So again, verse 21, this also is vanity and a great evil. One of the commentaries that I read this past week, the commentator shared a personal story of how he would go into, when he was a boy, like a five and dime store. And any time he went in there, the owner was working the cash register there. Early in the morning, late at night, didn't matter when you went in, that's where the guy was. He was just always there to service his business. He died, and his wife immediately declared to the whole town that she was going to be shutting down the business, selling its profits, and she began to use all of that money. In fact, she even showed the guy, remembers as a little boy, I remember her showing to me the cruise tickets that she had purchased. So here's her husband that had invested himself into this business. And as soon as he passes off the scene, the wife says, I don't want to do this. I'm going to sell everything that you worked for and take the money that you had earned, and I'm going to spend it on myself. And here's the cruise tickets that I'm going to use. You know, stories like that are not at all uncommon. That just seems to be normal. Whether the person really is untested, and when he's tested, he recognizes, I'm not a good businessman, I just blew everything. Or maybe when he's tested, he recognizes, you know what, I just don't have the same priority. So I'm going to sell it and just use the money on myself. We see this cycle over and over again. You know, on his own principles, the man of the world should hardly object to this, as long as what I earn lasts my lifetime. Right, which again is showing us the reality here. This man of the world is sharing with us our inbuilt longing for something that is permanent. I want a legacy to remain. I want inheritance that remains. I want work that remains. And I just have to pass it on to somebody else that's going to squander it. That doesn't seem right. You know, Solomon's own history is going to bear it out. Remember what happened to his kingdom? We talk about Israel under two categories, the United Kingdom and the Divided Kingdom. And do you remember where Solomon fits into all of that? Yeah, he's right at the break. His dad started this United Kingdom. He enhanced this United Kingdom. And when he died, he passed it on to Rehoboam and Jeroboam. And his kingdom was split. And just a few, really, decades later, the kingdoms would be in captivity. And so his own successors would fulfill exactly what he knew they would. Untested and unentitled, they would squander all of those material earnings that he had worked so hard for. Material earnings are passing. You probably experience that. We don't have a whole lot of working history from which to gain experience from, but probably many of us have worked long enough to be able to recognize, I remember when I had a lot more in my savings account, and then this happened, and this happened, or maybe I made some foolish decisions, or maybe work came and go, whatever it may be, those material earnings are passing. And what seemed so great, like I got a paycheck, and I blew the first one, and it was a great feeling. And then I got some wisdom, and I thought, you know, I really should invest it a little bit more. And now 5 years later, I look, and my investments seem to be really minimal too. Material earnings are passing. Well, he asks here in verse 22, what does a man really get from his labor? And if you're reading with Solomon, you're like, well, why are you asking that? Because you just kind of told us he doesn't get a whole lot. So why are you asking at this point, what does he get from his labor? It's because now he's shifting his focus a little bit. Okay, so material earnings are kind of passing. But what about, like, mentally? Can you earn some sense of satisfaction? Like, I just feel good about myself when I come home from a hard day's labor? Like physiologically, I just sense like I'm more complete when I'm at the workplace. I love watching shows like American Idol and all of those great shows that show the idolatry rampant in America. And there, I was on YouTube this past week, and I think it was Britain's Got Talent, actually. This one guy came out on stage so nervous. You could just see it in his whole body. He's so nervous. And he sings, and it's a beautiful song. The crowd goes nuts. The judges are in tears. They give him a standing ovation. And afterwards, he leaves the stage, and he goes out, and his wife comes and gives him a hug, and he says this to her: in that 1 second, I felt complete. I just finally felt complete in that one moment. Interesting way to put it. You know, the guy was probably in his early 40s, and apparently for 40 years he had felt incomplete as a laborer. And in that one moment he would profess, "I felt complete," but guess what? That moment when he said that had already passed away. So can I leave the workplace Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, Friday, go home and feel complete? So we come to number two and we ask, what are the mental earnings? What are the mental earnings? Well, they're punishing. They're punishing. In our mind and in our bodies, perhaps physiologically would be a better word to use here. Physiologically, when it comes to me as a person, what I feel in my body and my mind, can I get some benefit from work? Well, let's trace the effects with him. What effects do you see as you let your eyes scan verses 22 and 23 again? What words does he use to describe these mental effects? Verses 22 and 23. Just shout it out. Vexation of spirit, right? Vexation of heart. Sorrowful. Mm-hmm. No rest. And there's at least one more in there. Grief. Okay, those are the four terms. Okay, so what about the mental earnings? Okay, here they are, Solomon. Vexation of heart, sorrows, grief, and no rest. The word vexation is the same word used in the phrase vexation of spirit or chasing after wind. It refers to the unmet longings and aspirations frequently accompanied by anxiety. So when I look at my heart to see if it gives me a sense of peace, not only do I find no peace, I find the opposite. It's like wind that is constantly blowing. I just find myself constantly anxious, unmet longings and aspirations. Yeah, we obviously have deadlines and goals, and things aren't met and goals aren't achieved, and it seems like I'm always clutching for something that's just out of my reach, this vexation of heart. The word sorrows is usually rendered pain and suffering, and that's how he describes the workplace. Grief refers to that which causes frustration. So indeed, like he says in verse 23, there's no rest for the workaholic. Man, this is discouraging. Not only the effects, but secondly, the extent. The extent. Notice in verse 23, these effects are experienced both day and night. All throughout the day, there's this vexation of spirit, and at night, there is no rest. So from 8 to 5, I'm frustrated, I'm agenda-bound, things aren't happening right? And I'm frustrated because all of these things seem to be spiraling out of control. And no sooner do I meet one deadline than I immediately have another. And so what do I find myself doing at home at night in bed? I'm trying to figure out how tomorrow I can beat the rat race. And so throughout the day and at night, when we just get honest and come to the only conclusions that honesty allows, when I look at work, I recognize materially, the earnings are passing. Mentally, the earnings are punishing. I'll put on the website for us to look at this next week, but all you have to do is just a word search on workaholism, and you'll find article after article after article that deals with these punishing effects. 3,000 years later, people are still learning the hard way what Solomon experienced firsthand: frustration and no rest. So that leads us to our final point. Meaningful earnings. Are there any meaningful earnings in the workplace? Well, in verses 24 and 26, you probably even see it when you just look at your Bible. You can see it's a different paragraph. There's a change in tone here. That's because we actually get to the second half of this overarching idea, two ways to live. Right now, all he's been considering is life lived under the sun. But in verses 24 through 26, he actually looks at work practiced in the fear of God. And therein are meaningful earnings, which are providential. Meaningful earnings are providential. The curtains open up here, but just for a second. When we get into chapter 3, they're going to close again. So let's bask in the one ray of light that we see in these three verses here for a moment. In these three verses, we actually see a contrast between the righteous and the wicked. Categories introduced here. He hasn't dealt with those two groups before now. Here, he actually talks about the righteous and the wicked. So we'll just let our outline model his. Okay, number one, to the righteous, God gives fulfillment in his work. Solomon encourages us that in relation to our labor, verse 24, there's nothing better than to eat, drink, and enjoy good. But Both the ability to eat and to enjoy, he says, must come from God. Verse 24 and 25 is probably preferable to translate it this way, as most of the modern translations do. There's a variant there. This also have I seen, that is from the hand of God, for who can eat and who can have enjoyment without him? And how many people have earned lots of food and lots of houses and lots of activities, and when they try to find enjoyment therein, it's unsustained. It's immaterial. It's inadequate. Right? Because the ability to enjoy it has to come from God too. When you live under the sun, you've removed God from your worldview, and so the source of enjoyment has been removed. How can you possibly expect to enjoy anything? But when you're living under the fear of God, with God as the fountainhead of all that is good, you've appropriately positioned yourself to receive not just blessings, but the ability to enjoy those blessings as well. Now, he's not advocating hedonism here. Remember, chapter 2, verses 1 through 11, he pursued hedonism and he found it lacking too. No, what he is instead exhorting us to do is to accept and enjoy life as it comes to us from the hand of God. He says in verse 26 that to the man that is good in his sight, he gives wisdom and knowledge and joy. In chapter 9, verse 2, in chapter 8, verses 12 to 13, again in chapter 12, verse 14, that same phrase, the one who is good in his sight, is going to be identified as the one who lives in the fear of God. And when we operate within the fear of God, a daily recognition that the unseen is better and bigger than the seen, that the one that I can't see is more significant than everything I can see, that faith is more important than sight, when we're operating within that realm, we're positioning ourselves to receive from God fulfillment in our work. But on the other hand, number two, to the sinner, God gives futility in his work. Do you actually recognize in verse 26 there's a job description provided for the sinner there? If you're looking at the King James, it uses the word travail, a term we don't usually use today. It's just the same word as business. And verse 26 says, to the sinner, God gives him this business. Here's the job description. I want you to work hard so that you earn, and then you give your earnings to the righteous. That's what verse 26 says. Like, what a futile existence. Work hard and earn a lot of stuff so that you can give all that to the righteous. And we see that throughout the Old Testament, right? Israel spoiling Egypt on their way out during the Exodus, right? Remember that? Israel entering into Canaan and taking its plunder. Even Haman and Mordecai, remember that? Haman wanting to be exalted and instead having to be the one that exalts Mordecai. I mean, we see even on a physical level that sometimes God does allow the vanity of the wicked to be the blessing of the righteous. But for the righteous, we who walk by faith and not by sight, we recognize that ultimately the fulfillment of this is in the future. Our treasures are not stored on earth, but they're stored in a place where rust does not corrupt, where moth does not corrupt, and where thieves cannot break through and steal. And that is where our hope lies. And so in these verses, what we're discovering is that the solution may not be for you to get a different job. Okay, you're really frustrated at work. It may not be to cut down hours. The solution in the workplace is to change your thinking and to change your orientation. It's to wake up every day and to recognize I've got a choice to make. When I go to the workplace, am I going to operate merely under the sun, or am I going to work within the fear of God? Maybe this afternoon, to help yourself out, you simply want to Google a worker's prayer. You can find lots of them. In fact, on the notes that I'll put on the web this week, I found three of them that I thought are really helpful. These were ways that workers who recognize that the employment can sometimes be a rat race can be profitable and meaningful and satisfying if oriented rightly toward my God. So consider this as we close. Dear Lord, as I pray to you now, my mind is full of my work. Its pleasures and pains, its stresses and rewards are burned into my brain. Quiet my soul for these few moments and hear my prayer as one of your workers in the world. My work is hard, Lord. I need your counsel and comfort when things fall apart, when I'm confronted with evil, when my coworkers' needs are too great, when I'm tired to the insides of my brain, when work is not appreciated. My work is necessary, Lord. I need your gifts and spirit when things are developing well, when I'm making positive changes, when society is made better because of what I do, when I'm working efficiently and effectively, when I'm honored as a valuable worker. Every day of my work, I want to remember that you are my God. I need to know that you're there with me. I count on your blessings for my successes. I want to thank you for the chance to work in this workplace. And I need courage and conviction to see myself as your worker. For your gifts and your grace that come to me as a worker, I praise your name and thank you for being my God. Amen. You know, in the Garden of Eden, sin entered. And with it, a curse that ruined the workplace. On Mount Calvary, one work was done perfectly that rendered all of our work no longer cursed, but effective. That work was the work of Christ. And because his work was efficient, ours can be effective and satisfying too. Let's be rightly oriented when we hit the workplace tomorrow. God, thank you that you have forever, by what you did on Calvary and even in your lifetime, you have forever changed the dynamic of work. We read Genesis through Malachi, and all we read are of the difficulties of work. And when we turn to Matthew and we read its chapters, we recognize one work that was perfectly accomplished, achieved perfection, and lasted for eternity. Oh, what hope that gives us then tomorrow as we join with you in the work that you're continuing to do in the world today. God, if all we do tomorrow is go to earn another buck, is go to meet another deadline, to accomplish another project, we're missing the point. Father, help us to be rightly oriented to you, recognizing that the workplace to which we go tomorrow is your workplace. We are your worker, and may we operate within the fear of God. Lord, as we continue these thoughts even next week on the daily devotional, I pray that you would really help us to understand what Solomon is saying, the lessons that he learned, that we might learn from him rather than learning the hard way. Continue to teach us that apart from you, all things are futility, how our heart lies to us regarding the opposite. So today, as we pursue Christ in a community, may we encourage each other to believe truth. As we head to this next hour and we sing songs that extol the wisdom, the power, the justice, the holiness, the grace, the mercy, the compassion of our Christ, may we recognize that only at his right hand are pleasures forevermore. And so may we choose again this week to operate within the fear of God and find the satisfaction that that alone can bring. Lord, bless our friends today. May we please you with our hearts, even as we worship in this next hour. We pray in Christ's name. Amen.